You're listening to the Technology Whisperers with myself, Alistair Ross, and
Sean Muller.
Hi, Sean. It is episode 2 of season 3 of the Technology Whisperers. So welcome back and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually a really cool episode. Alistair and I are going to get down to our roots here and really the purpose of the Technology Whisperers. We're going to demystify some stuff. And Alistair, I think we're going to start with the actual acronyms. And yep. I hear these acronyms get thrown around. And we did that episode last season on CISOs. And CISO is one of those acronyms that gets thrown around that a lot of people don't know about. But we mentioned this particular acronym, SOC, and secondly, a SIEM. And those get thrown around a lot by security guys. And sometimes I think the security guys like to just acronym things to make them sound like they're cooler than they are.
Oh, they do. They do. And this, ladies and gentlemen, this episode is about socks and sock seam, but it's got nothing to do with the things that you wear on your feet.
No.
Just want to make that clear. All right. Yes. So SOC is S-O-C, and it stands for, Sean?
It's Security Operations Center.
I was just trying to catch you out there.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, if you go back far enough, previous to SOCs, there were these things called NOCs. Or network operations centers.
I remember.
And they usually handled the security as well. The NOCs tended to be responsible for firewalls and for, you know, antivirus servers and things like that. And then security became important enough that it was broken off into its own thing. And that's when they got the title a security operations center. So,
it wasn't always, you know, it was just the Knights of the Templar, right? Mm-hmm. It was the IT people. And they did everything. They did the security, they did the networking, they did the systems, the applications, the whole thing. And I'd like to say they were simpler times, but they were also very busy times. And I think you and I were both, you know, one of those people that just did everything. They were good times. I mean, I started out one day, I was a Windows NT 4 administrator. And in the same job, I was also the network guy, the security guy, the Linux sysadmin guy. When Linux was a new thing, I remember building Slackware. I'm totally going off on a tangent here. Building Slackware, the kernel, the Linux kernel from floppy disk. That was truly, Anyway, widely off topic there. Getting back to the topic, socks. So grassroots, what kind of thing is a SOC or Security Operations Center? Well, at its core, it has technical aspects to it, but ultimately, if you broke it all down and took the technology away from it, really, it's a team of people, usually security analysts, and they monitor, they detect, and they investigate and respond to cyber threats. So, you know, you've got these things in the Hollywood movies where you see screens going bleeping red and big lines of code running down them and lots of people in this big nerve center running around frantically when a hacker gets into their systems. Well, take the Hollywood out of that, and that's kind of what a SOC is, right? Is that somewhere about the right idea?
Yeah.
So, yeah, really, if you are a organization which has got a reasonably large amount of money, you might have your own SOC, okay? But there are also other types of SOC setups. Well, there's the fully managed SOC, where you basically outsource the whole thing. So that is the people and the technology that might be used in that SOC. Or there is a hybrid SOC. And a hybrid can actually take a number of guises. It could be like a SOC that has you outsource the human part of it to another company, or you outsource the technology, or you outsource technology and some of the human aspects. So you might do like 8x5 operations on your own, and then have the out-of-hours part located somewhere else with another company that manages that for you. They kind of dial into your SOC. So there's a fair few ways to skin the SOC cat, isn't there, Sean?
Oh, absolutely. And Alistair has really done a good job of explaining what down to, you know, the daily details of what they're doing and what their purpose is in being there. And they really are there to respond because, as we've talked about in previous episodes, business risk to security events happening can be very high. And the purpose of the SOC is to mitigate for those risks and to provide a response, like reasonable response that can get you back to a good state after an event happens. And so generally they have these great big long lists of logs that are constantly streaming through, and they're having to use tools to look at those logs and make decisions about which ones are good and which ones are bad, and to begin, you know, deciding how they're going to respond. They're generally picked part of some kind of ticketing system, and then they integrate with a whole bunch of other pieces of software and teams. So security architects, and we have governance people, and we have risk assessment and privacy people, and the CISO's office interacts with all of them. So Alistair, walk me through when a security analyst on a SOC sees an event happen. Maybe it's driven by the business calling them up and saying, hey, we think something's happened, or I have a ransomware notification on my computer. Or it might be that they see some piece of code go by that isn't supposed to happen. Like they see a database server that suddenly is hosting a web server out to the internet. What is that incident response system?
That's a very good question, Sean. So basically, in a well-defined SOC, and I think that's the important thing, you know, we get different shapes and sizes. I've talked there briefly just about the different models, like the in-house and the fully managed and the hybrid and all the rest. But ultimately, any of those setups can be good SOCs, and they can also be bad SOCs. So if you don't well-define the processes around incident response inside your SOC, then you probably miss things. And that's a bad day for a SOC. That's a really bad day. You don't want to miss things. And in fact, a lot of the times what SOCs find is they get false positives and false negatives and so forth. So a lot of those cases, they have to work through those false positives, for example, the analysts inside the SOC, to find out, you know, if they are. But it's better to find the things that are, you know, false positives than actually not see the incidents going through it. But like you said, like they can be people who just, you know, like a help desk, they phone up the SOC and they say, hey, I've got something really odd going on with XYZ system here. And that is one way, sure. The trouble ticketing system is another way. You know, it just could be people reaching out inside of the business. But much more these days, we have a layer of software and automation that's involved in the SOC. And, you know, back in the day, kind of where you started talking there about the NOC, you had the network operations and network security. So if we think about a frontline perimeter of our networks, at least traditionally, and we're moving away from this sort of methodology these days into sort of more zero trust. But if we still consider the classic, the castle and moat sort of style of network security, we have the firewall and we have our perimeter, and it says like all these things. They would often have alerts coming in from firewalls to say, hey, there's something bad happening here. But how many times have you been in front of a firewall and looked at the logs consistently? No, usually what happens is people find something that isn't working quite right, and then they'll look at the logs retroactively. Yeah. And obviously the whole idea of a SOC is to be proactive and find incidents either as they're happening, which is not great, or before they might happen, so they're like just about to happen. So it's a just-in-time based process. And so having these well-defined processes, guidelines, including around detection and the assessment, and then once you've actually found something, about how you prioritize that versus all the other incidents that might be going on. So here's a case in point. You might have like some malware that's found its way onto Alice's computer, right? And that's popped up on your software, your reporting software. I'll come back to what that software is called in a moment. I'm just going to throw another acronym at you. I'm just going to hold off on that just for a second. But basically, you've got that assessment process to work it, right? So I've got on Alice's PC here, I've got an alert that's popped up to say, hey, I've got some ransomware is pretty bad stuff. Malware. So run-of-the-mill kind of malware. And then on Bob's computer, now Bob usually logs in from, let's just say, Texas, speaking to another Texan, right? So we've got Bob down in Texas. We're in the SOC somewhere else, doesn't really matter where. But what's happening on Bob's computer is something rather weird, or with Bob's persona. Usually he logs into his Office 365, his Microsoft Active Directory system, and he logs in from Texas, Monday to Friday, what's happening today is that we've got Bob, but he's, instead of logging in from Texas, he's logging in from North Korea on a Sunday at 3 a.m. So all of those things don't sound legit, but a good SOC analyst has got to prioritize whether Alice's issue with our malware is the priority or whether Bob's issue is the priority. So that's a really human-based process. Now, you can get machines and automation to help you with that, but in the end of the day, it comes down to the human being as to where they want to prioritize these particular tasks. And so that's a really important value point that a SOC provides. And so that's prioritization. And then how to respond to that issue as well is a really crucial aspect. How quickly do we respond? Yeah. What actions do we take when we respond? And we've got to include all of the roles and responsibilities about that whole process of communication across our entire business.
So and that's let's highlight that, because this is where the SOC is kind of the pointy end of the stick for security events happening, and all kinds of security events. And so that integration with the business, that the business processes. So how do we, who do we notify? In New Zealand, it's, we've had a privacy breach. We have to notify the Privacy Commission.
Yep.
So that's a business process that has to go off. If you're in the States and you have some kind of security event that exposes a significant portion of your customers' data, then you have to report that to the SEC, and there are other agencies. And those are all business processes that have to take into account. And so the SOC has to be aware of that for the prioritization. The business portion of it is the most important part of what the SOC does.
I totally agree. So if you think about all of this, these are around what we've said so far are around incidents or potential incidents that are about to happen, right? But we all, that's part of the puzzle. But also another part of the puzzle is about the threat intelligence. So what I mean by that is that out there in the wild, we've got threats that are real, tangible threats. Just this week past, for example, we've had two major threats, I guess. One of them was in Microsoft's Office 365 and Office Suite software, which allowed remote code execution and was deemed a critical vulnerability by Microsoft. And another one was by Fortinet on their FortiGate products, so the VPN and the firewall itself. And both of those vulnerabilities were classified as critical as well. So unusual week in security, quite big threats. And so being appraised of these and having some sort of, again, consistent feed for those threats is really important. Now, again, you could do that manually. You could just subscribe to RSS or Security News website and read all those things. But ultimately, doing that is kind of manual, and there's always going to be gaps. And if you have a whole SOC team there, you're going to have to educate each member in the SOC team about these threats constantly. You can see that that might break down quite quickly. And there's only so many items in a threat feed that one human being can hold in their head forever. So this is where the whole process of automation, about alert management, about incident response, all of these aspects are just lending themselves to having some sort of automation. And the automation that we typically use is called a SIEM, S-I-E-M, Security Incident Event Management, okay? And there are loads of companies out there trying to sell you SIEM software, and I'm not going to tell you which one that you should go and look at. But, there are big names in it. Everybody from Microsoft and CrowdStrike and, you name it. There are lots of different companies all doing that sort of product. Some are definitely better than others. And even the ones at the top of the product's name, they have their nuances. So what I would say is choose your SOC carefully based on your needs. And sometimes it's very difficult to understand your needs. I think a lot of people get caught out when they look at the sort of fire hose effect. Because what happens is often when you install one of these SIEM products, how they work is they ultimately have a sort of, they tap into all of your endpoints, like your servers and your storage and your networking equipment and your applications. And so if you think about it, it really quickly becomes all of your IT assets, all of your infrastructure. And the problem with that is, your SIEM, when it gets up to speed, is getting firehosed. It's getting loads and loads and loads of data, all these logs from all of these devices on your network, thrown at it all the time. And sometimes the licensing model around these SIEM products uses ingestion-based licensing. And that can be really expensive if you've got everything thrown at it. So then, unfortunately, when you've got a license model like that, you might have to start switching things off and going, actually, it's not that important that we look at the logs of S3 buckets in Amazon, AWS, or it's not that important to look at events coming in from our email server. You're having to make choices, which I would say you probably don't want to make. Those are things that you probably want as much as you want, as much as you can get. But then how much do you store? There's all sorts of considerations about that.
And this is one of the things, and you know, there are very few times when I would say, you need to go get a consultant. This is one of the few times that unless your company is in IT, and then I would assume that you would, me assuming, that you would be taking the right steps. But business security is not your, IT security is not your field of expertise. I would recommend getting a consultant or somebody to come in and help you. Because Alistair's absolutely right. Picking the right SIEM and making sure that you're getting the right value out of it. And this is where a lot of SOCs go wildly, wildly wrong. Oftentimes, the way the SOCs deal with the fire hose is to begin blocking everything that they don't have a process written to deal with. So the licensing costs are too much. Oh, we're getting too many messages. We can't handle all the messages. So unless someone has defined a process for us to handle a message and defined what it means, then we're going to block everything else. And the problem with that is that most incidents that happen today that really catch people out are zero-day incidents, that there's nobody that has a process written for them because the event hasn't occurred yet. So one of the things that SOC needs to be able to do is it needs to be able to identify anomalies when things happen that shouldn't be happening. And Alistair's example of, you know, Bob logging in North Korea when he works in Texas is a perfect example of that's an event that would never have happened before. So you may not have a procedure for it. So if the SOC chose to block all those messages because they have no procedure for it, you've just potentially lost your company. And there was, interestingly enough, there was just recently a post on LinkedIn about this. There was a accountant that thought he was having a call with his CFO on a video call, and his CFO and a CEO and a vice president were all deep fakes, and he transferred $25,000 in his company over to a bank account that is he thought his CFO was telling him to do. And
it's,
the SOC,
it's crazy.
The SOC wouldn't have any, how, if somebody called up the SOC and said, hey, I think a deep fake of the CFO just told me to transfer $25,000. And the SOC went, we don't have a procedure to handle that.
Well, I mean, that's when I have trained my voice. So this could be a fake me, but I can train my voice on a script. So basically I've got a YouTube channel and I want to train AI to basically sound like me, rather than sounding like a robotic Englishman or American, right? And I can train my voice within 30 seconds of listening to me speak normally, and it goes off and it sounds almost identical to me, which is really scary. And then this week we're seeing like the Sora from OpenAI coming out shortly as well. So the technology really is getting very mature and it's coming out right now. So yeah, really, really scary to sort of see this sort of stuff happening in real. And this is what happened to Uber, right? Isn't it?
That's right. That's right. That's exactly what. And to clarify what I'm saying about bringing a consultant in, look, you can have a very good platform. Microsoft Security Essentials is a very good security platform. Splunk, very good security platform. But if you don't know what you're getting into and you're not implementing it correctly and you're not putting the processes in place, you're gonna struggle with getting the outcome. And the outcome is protecting your business from a security event happening within the technology space. Yeah. So my recommendation, and I don't have a platform recommendation to what Alistair said, there are lots of really good platforms out there. But my recommendation would be to have a conversation with a consultant ahead of time, unless your business is in this space and then you feel comfortable doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I mean, you definitely don't want to be making a decision which is going to cost you heaps and heaps in the future. And a lot of them start off really affordable. I'm not picking on you here, Microsoft. Here is just an example, though. If you have Microsoft's Sentinel-based product, really, really good product overall, but the licensing model kind of works on ingestion from a Microsoft world. So if everything you do is in Azure and you're 100% on the Microsoft landscape in Azure, then you're probably going to have relatively low costs. But like everybody, the world is not that simple. We have
multi-cloud.
We've got stuff in AWS, we've got maybe stuff in Google, and then we've probably got on-prem stuff as well. As soon as you start getting ingesting all of that, it costs you more. And if you want to egress any of that, you know, put that out somewhere else, even just some of the logs or some of the data, the analysis data, wherever, as soon as it goes back out of Sentinel, again, there is a charge for that. So that's just an example of one product, and it's a good product. I'm not going to bag it too much. I'm just saying that,
no,
you know, just because it's Microsoft, just because it's Sentinel, it's a top-ranking product, doesn't necessarily mean it's the right product for you. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, and I see this a lot of time in the cloud architecture spaces, is that they are good products. They are designed to be an optimum product for an enterprise. But what often gets seen is that because the people implementing it aren't necessarily experts in that particular platform, they don't implement it to optimize it for your business. So they don't spend enough money. Maybe they cut back so far that the tool becomes useless. Or maybe they spend way too much money because they have a whole bunch of stuff enabled that they shouldn't have enabled. So having someone that can understand the platform. And so we're really focusing here on event management. But Alistair touched on threat intelligence. Threat intelligence is the secondary aspect of that. So that's the feeds that tell you, hey, this zero-day thing is happening. Hey, we've identified a bug in this piece of software. And by the way, we noticed that you have 10 servers in production that are all vulnerable to that bug. That's all that threat intelligence. And then, you know, what's happening within the landscape of your technology,
yeah,
oftentimes isn't a log. It's literally, oh, you know, the server over here that's running Windows 2003, you haven't updated that. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's 2024 and it's, you know, it's vulnerable to attacks. And oh, by the way, it has a public internet virtual IP address that is going directly to it with no firewall on it. That's not necessarily an incident, but it's an indication of something that may be a risk.
Yeah. So you've got a great side there of threat intelligence. It knows what the SIEM knows, what vulnerabilities are out there on the internet, not just for today, not just for the O-day, zero-day stuff, but also the past as well, the whole catalog of previous issues. And sometimes those issues could be like a CVE score of, you know, a low severity. And then 2 years later, that gets bumped up to higher ranking because, you know, that issue has become much widely exploited and so forth. A good SIEM solution will have this capability or notion of threat intelligence and be able to map that against your assets. So, yeah, so in the last season, we talked to Anna and she was talking about the importance of having your assets all tracked, and that was using a framework like NIST or ISO. And that's great. That's a really good idea. And basically, your SIEM should have a reflection of those same assets so that it knows if there are any vulnerabilities, it knows about all of your landscape, not just part of it. So that's why, you know, when we're talking about the vulnerabilities of your machines, those assets, having a list of all those assets are really good, both on paper, but also in the software that you're using. Now, I'm going to talk quickly. Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
So I was going to say, what that leads us on to the next thing, which is integration with other teams. Oftentimes, operations centers, network operations centers, systems operations centers don't have a lot of connection in with other teams. They just focus on the area that they're in. The SOC is different. There has to be collaboration with other across teams because oftentimes the SOC isn't the one correcting for the incident. They're just identifying it and then starting the business process to go.
Yeah.
So do you want to take us a little bit more in depth into that?
I mean, I think you've covered the main highlights there, Sean, but ultimately the SOC, usually you'll have sort of level one, level two, level three, just as you do in sort of IT support. And the incident handlers, the initial point of contact, are going to be those level one, level twos. And then for the people who, you know, the gurus, I guess, or the people who are going to actually work on resolving the tougher problem, they're going to be in the level three. And that's all good to have an understanding of, wow, the SOC's doing its thing and these problems that go under the hood. But ultimately, the difference between an IT operational help desk or whatever and a SOC is that the SOC is dealing with issues that could potentially impact your business. So every business hopefully is doing or has done a risk assessment to go, right, what's the big things that could hit us? You know, it's a building falling down, an earthquake, whatever. Cyber's got to be in that risk assessment. And if the people within the SOC are analyzing threats coming through the wire, or indeed actual potential incidents, you know, if they've either happened or they were blocked, but they almost happened, that sort of information needs to trickle through to the rest of the business so that the rest of the business can understand and be informed about what decisions they need to make going forward with regards to the risk. So that could really change the landscape when it comes to board level decisions about, okay, well, our business is under more threat, so what should we be doing properly to protect our assets? And our assets, again, should remind you, is not just technology. In fact, if anything, it's the least part of it is technology. It's the people, the processes, the data, yeah, all of these aspects. So yes, having a good bilateral amount of communication between your SOC and other areas that's important in your business, which includes IT, includes maybe developer staff, legal, and of course the board. So we're talking about the CISO there, ideally, or the CTO or the CIO, but basically people who can take the information that's coming through and get a good report from the SOC and submit that to the board as and when necessary. That's a really important aspect through collaboration. So yeah, really, really good point there, Sean. Another aspect is a piece of technology which has come along more recently. So the SIEM products out there are becoming fairly mature. These products have been around for at least a decade now. Whereas another thing called SOAR, which is Security Orchestration Automation and Response, I think. I should know that part. But yeah, so basically a lot of SIEMs are now pivoting to include the SOAR as part of their offering. Sometimes it's two separate products, but you may find like the sort of top in the Gartner quadrant, those guys are doing SIEM and SOAR together, which is really cool. So what is SOAR, I hear you ask?
I do want you to go into depth with SOAR, but let's touch on this a little bit. Why? So, I mean, in previous times, you and I have talked about a benefit of automation and AI-driven automation for helping with business processes and things like that. So the devil's advocate in me says, well, all operation centers need some kind of automation. And why do SOCs need that before? Why are the security guys, the security analysts getting that before? Do we not have enough of them? Is it that they're getting too many incidents? What is it that's driving us towards platform maturity in the space with security?
Oh, look, I think I'd like to say that there's platform maturity, but ultimately, I don't know if I'd agree with that statement overall. I think we're still, it's been around a while, the SIEM, for example,
yeah.
But I don't know if we're fully mature yet. I think that the product evolution has still got a way to go. And one of those evolutions is the advent of SOAR. And what I would like to see in a perfect world is that SIEM and SOAR become just one product, right? It's not two separate things. But obviously I've talked about IT help desks before, and you know, we're all familiar with the thought of having tickets flow in and processes getting done through that. Sometimes if we've got a really advanced ticketing system for well-known IT-based problems, such as, I don't know, Outlook stopped working, you know, the answer can often password resets, have you switched it off and on again, that sort of thing. That process is actually being automated through some of the better IT help desk software. And some of the IT chatbots now are even doing some of that as well, which is cool, I think. So what we're having in the SIEM world is basically the totally integrated SIEM SOAR, and the SOAR part is taking those security incidents, looking at them, and if they match a particular pattern, they're able to create a ticket for them in the it might not be the same system as the help desk. It's usually in the SOAR help desk system because it's for security professionals as opposed to the general IT professionals. That's totally fair enough. But it will create a ticket. Sometimes they do integrate with things like ServiceNow, so that isn't completely true. And so, yeah, basically it'll create a ticket. It will potentially assign somebody or something if it doesn't know how to do the automation. But the automation part of it is quite cool, and it's getting cleverer and cleverer to say, hey, look, this account, here's Bob. He's usually in Texas. That's his normal, you know, the system knows his normal routine, but then goes, hey, we've got a blacklist of countries and North Korea's on it. And Bob doesn't really ever log in at 3 a.m. So there's a black item here. There's a black item there. This doesn't look right. So it already has, and you can pre-program these things, by the way, but there's also some level of built-in automation to go, this is not right. So it can go, right, North Korea, bad IP, bad login time, potentially doing some nefarious looking stuff on the network, but does have a legitimate username and password here. So he's got past level one, but I don't think this looks legit. What I'm going to do for you as a SOAR product, completely automated, I'm going to lock out this user account. Starting right now, I'm going to create a ticket to that effect. I'm going to tell the help desk this is what's going on. It's 3 a.m. Nobody's going to be around to solve this problem. I'm going to do all that automatically. So that's where the SOAR, if you've got a good SOAR, again, not everyone is created equal, but if you've got a really good SOAR, it's going to find these things automatically and sort of get what I would say right now is the low-hanging fruit. In the future, what we're going to see is more AI assistance in this world. So then it's got a bit of machine learning, not just whitelists, blacklists, and pre-configured rule sets, which is kind of where we're at the moment with a little bit of additional intelligence on the side. So we're going to see those products really evolve over the next 2 to 3 years with AI, I reckon. And yeah, so it's quite exciting to see that. But the SIEM and the SOAR really combined is where we're at right now. And I think it's going to increase in performance over the next few years.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, responding to incidents and responding to anomalies and, you know, some of the tools. Is there, I'm going to lead you, Alistair.
I'm worried now.
Is there a SOC function where they go out looking for vulnerabilities? I mean, because most of the people that listen to this podcast will say, well, you know, we do pen testing when we roll out a new piece of software, but oftentimes there's a vulnerability that, you know, you don't get a bug notification about the vulnerability. It's just, if you aren't aware that something is misconfigured, does the SOC have an ability to go out and look for those vulnerabilities, the things that could be out there that the business may not be aware of or the IT department may not be aware of?
Yeah. The answer is yes and also no. Again, it really comes down to how good your SIEM solution is. Some will provide automated and partially automated vulnerability management. So the whole idea of the vulnerability management is it will explore all of the assets that you have connected to the SIEM. And the way that these usually work is that the asset itself, say, as I said, the server or storage or whatever it may be, that'll have an agent installed on it. It's a little piece of software that calls home to the SIEM, all right? And it just sends this information always, you know, constantly up to these. And sometimes you have log aggregators in the middle because there's a lot of logs, as you can imagine. So one little server, one little SIEM software on one little server might be a lot to take. So there's sort of aggregators as well that deal with all of that information. So vulnerability management basically will do additional things, not just collect those logs and analyze the logs on the SIEM. It will allow a two-way relationship between the SIEM and the asset. And it will do things like check what's patch level you've got on your server. Okay, I'm out of date here. It'll check for software that's residing on the machine that looks like malware. So which kind of crosses over into the XDR kind of territory, but it can do, there are SIEMs out there that do that sort of stuff. And it will also check for commonly known software applications that are vulnerable as well. So not just operating systems, I'm talking like I mentioned Word and Excel and Office 365, all that sort of stuff. So it'll look at the software installed on the machine, do a complete asset count not only just of the machine itself, but also the operating system and the software on it, and will check for known vulnerabilities against those sort of streams that I talked about before. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea that the SIEMs could be more proactive and the SOC could provide a more proactive, almost threat hunting, looking for threats in the environment, not just responding to threats that somebody from outside identified along with that. So in that same vein, so I'm prior military, right? So there's this thing where we used to do where we pretended to be the bad guy and try and break into stuff, which is a lot of what pen testing does, right?
Yeah.
But there is this thing called red teaming that oftentimes more advanced SOCs will come in and do full vulnerability assessments across a wide range of areas within an IT landscape, especially a large enterprise organization. In your opinion, unless you're a really large multinational organization, that kind of service, do you think it would be valuable?
You mean having it in your own SOC? So look, I think if you're a very large organization, of which in New Zealand there's probably only about 5 or 10, right? Then you probably can't afford to be doing that all the time. So you probably can't afford to have your own red team fully employed constantly. So those are the sorts of things that you would probably hire pen testing or even vulnerability assessments for. So for example, my business, Revolution InfoSec, we've written a on-demand vulnerability scanner software, Kiwi-built software, which basically allows you to go into a dashboard and then enter, like, say, your web presence, and it will scan your web presence for, so it could be a website, it could be a mobile app or a web app API as well. And you just pop in the URL of what it is, and then it goes off and does that. It's probably much more affordable to have another provider or consultant do that sort of vulnerability assessment. So the vulnerability assessment is the cheaper one, right? Vulnerability assessment is like basically, hey, have I got vulnerabilities in X, Y, and Z that could potentially be exploited? Pen testing is taking that list of vulnerabilities that we found. So basically it's the first part. Vulnerability scanning is the first part. Usually you get a report at the end of that vulnerability scan. And then pen testing is basically trying to jackknife those vulnerabilities and seeing if they can get in, you know, just keep trying and trying with different tools and different mechanisms to get into those weaknesses that they've found. So that is quite an expert process. And a lot of the time, there is a lot of manual work involved in the pen testing. And certainly, it depends on who you've got hired and so forth. There's all sorts of different types of techniques that one uses with pen testing. And of course, you would have on-premise pen testing. You might be inside your network. You might be external to your network. It might be physical pen testing. That's going and clicking locks, the physical locks. And then the sort of white box and gray box and black box where you do have logins to the network, or you don't have logins, or you sort of have some level of access. All those sorts of things exist within pen testing. So oftentimes you'll find that an organization of New Zealand scale, you still need to get these services, but you probably only need them once a quarter or, you know, at the most once a month. So you hire a consultancy to do those sorts of things for you. And yeah, so I think like having a baseline vulnerability scan and having something that you do routinely and you can do it quite easily at a click of a button, that's why Revolution InfoSec, my business, that's why we made that, because I thought, hey, it's too expensive, it's too time consuming, and it's just, you know, it needs to be done really easily. So that's why that service was built. I don't want to keep going on about it, but that's the sort of, there's a perfectly good reason for that service being in place in New Zealand. So anyway, moving on. I wanted to talk about like how we actually go around improving these processes and so forth. So one of the things that as a CISO or just anybody who's responsible for the security at a governance level inside an organization, you want to obviously have a report about how these things are going, how these are tracking. We talked a bit about this earlier on, but ultimately those things should be KPI driven. Right. So you should understand what those KPIs should look like to begin with, set those KPIs, and then report on those KPIs at an interval that you're happy with. But I would say at the very least once a month. Right. And those get reported to the board or the SLT at some level. And those KPIs will include things like MTTD. So there's another acronym, which I'll bust for you. Mean time to detect. All right. So how long does it take us on average to detect an anomaly, a security anomaly? And then MTTR, which is the mean time to respond. And I'm sure you get what that means. And then, you know, it's all about the communication clearly to stakeholders in the organization about how we're tracking on those numbers. And I think a lot of individuals, I've talked about this before in different podcasts, is that a lot of organizations have a very technical, you know, glass on this. And that's a problem because it really turns a board off, right? There's nothing more boring than hearing statistics and then statistics layered upon technology, and it just gets boring. And, you know, the board will switch off. They really need to know how much it's going to cost them, how much it's going to cost them going forward, and then what the risk is to the business, you know, if there's going to be any issues in the future or, you know, at the present as well.
So, and this is this is something that, you know, we've talked about this quite a bit, is that we need to get better, and the security team, as much, if not more so, needs to get better at talking to the business in ways that business understands. And so if you're a SOC and your KPIs are all esoteric KPIs that are aimed specifically at security analysis, vulnerability analysis, bug patching, and you're not going into the business and explaining to the business what the value is that you're providing for them, oftentimes what you'll find is that the security operations center gets less and less funding every year.
Yeah.
Which is a bad outcome because it's putting the business at risk in a way that is not sustainable. Eventually the SOC will become effectively useless, and then a security event will happen and the whole business will shift and try and spend the money. And ultimately, what I have seen, my experience is that a lot of times companies end up outsourcing their entire SOC to some other company because they identify that they can't do it internally. And that may not be the case. If they had done a better job communicating to the business in ways that the business could understand, then they would get proper funding, and then and ultimately it would be better for the business because outsourcing isn't necessarily cheaper. It is sometimes more effective, but not cheaper.
Yeah, I guess it really depends on how much time you're willing to invest in starting up your SOC, configuring your SOC, ongoing maintenance, and then, you know, just keeping that wheelhouse running, because it isn't something that you can set up in a day and, you know, see results from. You really have to spend a lot of time configuring it. I was speaking to a fella just 2 days ago, Friday, today's Monday. I was speaking to a fella on Friday, and he was interviewing for a large multinational pharmaceutical company, and they've done a cloud migration recently. And he said to me that they haven't yet fully configured their SOC. And that kind of really sort of sends alarm bells to me. It's like, well, you know, how much of not configured are we talking about here? And it could be quite a scary aspect. And so they're in-housing their SOC. But if they're not able to get on top of that after a significant amount of time, it sounded, then that could be quite worrying, because you're talking about really key critical infrastructure here. So yeah, there's arguments for and against outsourcing. It really depends on what your situation is and how much resource you're willing to throw at. And it's a kind of a bell curve. Expending time and effort at the beginning is very high, and then it'll sort of go back down again, and then you're kind of off and running. And so what I was going to say in terms of in continuous improvement, that keeping that comms with the board is one thing, but also always looking at ways to improve operations. So you evaluate your processes, your tools, and your technologies. So the technology fit might have been the right one when you started your SOC, but technology and the tools out there all improve at different speeds. So for example, Cisco are really starting to, they made a number of acquisitions in AI recently. And so a lot of the new tech they're bringing along in the networking and also the security space is using AI. So that's really cool to hear that they are doing it and doing it successfully, whereas other companies might not be putting AI in and using it successfully, or it might be a security risk in cybersecurity software. That's not what you want to hear. So, well,
and,
you know,
and this goes back to that constantly being engaged with the other teams, right? Because if the cloud operations team has decided they're going to migrate everything from Azure to AWS, nobody would do that. It would just be a massive mess, but the migration portion of it. But if the security operations center is not across that, then if they're not aware of what's happening, then they get caught. The, you know, 6 months down the line, everything's been migrated and the SOC is not getting any notifications because all of their stuff is built around Azure. And the SOC really has to be integrated tightly with the other teams. They have to know what's going on, the vulnerability scans that go on, the reports that are coming out of the vulnerability scans. All of that has to happen as part of ongoing software development and ongoing maintaining of the technology environment. And so the SOC really has to be aware of what's going on. You can't stick them in a closet someplace and pretend like, yeah, they're just going to get all of the incidents that we send them and they will keep us secure. Because to your point, when we began this, is that we're no longer a moat with a castle in the middle. The SOC isn't just looking at firewall and IDS logs. That's just not the case anymore.
No, it's not. It's absolutely not the case. You got it completely spot on. And we did talk about that in the Zero Trust podcast, if you want to listen back to that episode on what Zero Trust is all about. But yes, absolutely the case these days. We can't just assume that everything in our network is secure. We really have to, you know, perform three levels of validation on every single asset, whether it's inside or outside of our physical network. So yeah, going back to what I was saying there, performing post-incident reviews and involving each of the other area of the business. So like Sean was saying, not just the SOC being informed, but the SOC informing others. It works both ways. And, you know, how growing maturity across your business, again, you can't just have the SOC resolving tickets and then not telling everyone. You have to get involved and doing things like table topic interviews, you know, talking about scenarios like what if scenarios, or even things that they've seen in the SOC and then disseminating that into the rest of the business. Those are really helpful things that will keep the SOC relevant and also keep the rest of the business appraised. And it makes people actually think. And so rather than just here's a report saying X, Y, Z, this happened this week, if you start to get people interacting and saying, hey, we could have this particular cyber event, what would you do? And leave it up to the imaginations of other people inside the organization. That's an incredibly powerful way of communicating is happening or what could happen inside the SOC, and ultimately that drives up value, but also the ability of the individuals inside the organization to really understand the importance of these cyber events and what's happening. So yeah, that's what I would say in terms of continuous improvement.
So we've covered quite a bit around SOCs. I mean, where we started was, if you didn't know anything about a security operations center, our starting point was we defined what a SOC was. And we talked about several of the different security platforms that could go along a SIEM or a SOAR and the value that it has, the SOC can bring if it's invested in correctly and if it's the correct products are chosen and the business processes are followed. Is it, you know, your company, Revolution InfoSec, you guys do this. You advise companies on, would there be, what is the advice that you would be giving to businesses that are looking at doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Sean. Look, I think the main thing is that there is no one shoe size fits all, right? You've got to understand, first of all, what your assets are, where they are. So some are in the cloud, some of them are on-prem, you know, all that sort of stuff. Have a true understanding of your assets. And like the NIST framework is a really good example of how to get a feel for the cybersecurity posture of an entire organization. And we start with that identify phase, identify all the things, get all of those in a row. So if you haven't done that as an organization yet, and then attributed risk to this, so basically saying, what's the confidentiality need of this? Like if the confidentiality of that file server that has finance written on the front of it, that information, which we believe is confidential, was it not, if we lost the confidentiality of that next week, would that be a big deal? And the answer is probably yes. So that gets a confidentiality score high. And then in integrity, what happens if that information was corrupted? We still had that information, but it got damaged. Would that matter? And if the answer is yes, then again, we get a high score for the I. And then availability, you know, what happens if that information went away tomorrow? So we basically get all the list of all of the assets and then attribute those CIA values to each of them and start. Then we can start having an understanding of the risk. So once we've got that, that gives us a really, really strong understanding of how we should attribute these items inside our SOC. And obviously, if we've got some really low risk items that really we don't care about, that there is an opportunity to say, well, actually, we might not want to put them in the SOC. But ultimately, more is better. And if you haven't done that analysis of what you've got, then you're on a hiding to nothing. So always start with what you've got. Do that whole asset discovery. There are some software out there that will help you with the asset discovery. You might be doing this already, which is fantastic. If you're not, do it anyway. Even if you don't ever want to have a SOC, do it anyway, because this is a great exercise, not even just for things cybersecurity. It's just general risk management 101. So once you've done that, get together and try and understand what you need out of a SOC. Like, what sort of response times do you need? What sort of budget do you have? You know, all these sort of critical things about, you know, what do you actually need a SOC for? And once you've figured out all of these things, then and only then can you start to have a look at the products. So it's way down the line. It's like, you know, so far down the line. And there's so many products and there's so many things that are snake oil as well. And so many people that will sell you the dream and then you get to the reality and it's not quite what they sold. So there's always those aspects in the sales process as well. So you've really got to know what questions to ask. So if you're au fait with, you know, these products out there, and you know what all of these products make and what they do, that's fantastic. But if you don't, then like you said earlier on, it's probably best to use a consultant to give you a narrowed down view of what products you might want. And they might say to you, well, here's the top three or the top two even. That's great. That's pretty much where you want to go. And then obviously you need to make a decision on whether you're going to outsource the whole thing, whether you're going to do a hybrid configuration, or whether you're just going to run it all yourself. And that's really a down to what sort of headcount you can afford. And generally speaking, security never goes to sleep. There's always hackers everywhere in the world at any time. So you're probably going to find that you want a 24/7 SOC. So who's going to do the shift work? All that sort of stuff as well. That's reality of a security SOC. So yeah, and of course, here's the plug bit. If you want to talk about these things and design your needs, obviously you can reach out to me, and no obligations, of course. You can chat to me and I can sort of help you get in the right shape of mind for where you go next on your SOC journey. But if you have an organization with more than a handful of assets, whether they're in the cloud or whether they're on-prem, that doesn't matter. You probably need a SOC is where we're going with this.
I think we could wrap at that point.
Yeah.
And if someone wanted to reach out to you, Alistair, how would they do that? Where would they reach you at?
Well, the business, the website itself is revolutioninfosec.com. So that's revolutioninfosec.com, all one word. So yeah, head over there. There's a contact us page there as well. You can book out some time in a meeting, do a Google Meet. Or you can catch me on LinkedIn, of course, LinkedIn, and just search for Alistair Ross in Wellington, New Zealand. And yeah, obviously on Twitter and YouTube and all that good stuff as well. But that's the general way. What about yourself, Sean?
Oh, I'm all over the social media. Between Alistair and I, although I've done security work in the past, I'm not the security guy. So I tend to be all over the social medias. You can look for me, Sean G. Muller, and reach out. Also, if you see us, if you run into us and you happen to have listened to the podcast, let us know. We love talking to people that listen to us on the podcast and getting your impression. And in that vein, if you come up with an idea and you're like, I don't know how this works, maybe Alistair and Sean can demystify this for us. Reach out to us and let us know, because we get ideas from listeners all the time about things that, and sometimes we drag them onto the podcast.
Yeah, and I can't wait for that. We've actually got some coming up, and you can maybe tell everyone what those are all about, Sean. But I had somebody come up to me last week and say, hey, why are you guys not doing a visual podcast? Why is it just audio? And I thought, that's a You don't want to see our faces on this. But there you go, Sean. I'm just putting it to you. It's been asked for now. So, you know, there's a lot of sad people out there that want to see us as well as hear us.
There's no sad people that want to see us. You and I can have a discussion offline if we want to expand this podcast into a YouTube channel where we videocast as well. We could have maybe we throw it out to the audience, and if we get enough people voting, coming back to us voting that they want that they want a video podcast, maybe we'll have to figure out how to make that happen.
It really is a scary thought, but you know, whatever. I'm willing to do it if you are. Yeah, but there you go. So, Sean, we've got some guests that are coming up sometime soon. Do you want to talk about that briefly before we finish off?
So, I do and I don't, Alistair, because we're still setting up the schedule for when they come on to the podcast. And I don't want to give a name and say, hey, next week it's going to be such and such, and then there's no way that we can make it happen. But Alistair's absolutely right. We have some really cool guests coming on. Hopefully, we'll have a guest from season 2 coming back. That would be really awesome. And we may even be branching. Maybe there'll be a video cast that we do on somebody else's video cast that we can recast as a podcast that may come in the future. But it is coming. Look, Alistair and I love having guests come on and talk to us, especially since we don't claim to be experts at everything. And getting a chance to talk to experts in other fields is massively powerful for me as well, for Alistair.
Yeah. And look, we're not, you know, stuck on a particular topic. You know, I talked to somebody the other night as well, and I was quite interested not only in his technical chops, but also his business acumen and really how he became where he is today. And I thought that was a really compelling story. And so I'm trying to nudge him to come on to the podcast and share his story. So there was a bit of business in there, not just the technology. So I know we're called the Technology Whisperers, but, you know, I'm quite okay to branch out a little bit in areas which are kind of related. So he works in technology, but he's also a businessman.
And we've done that a couple times, right? Yeah. I mean, we had Amanda came on and talked to us a little bit about demystifying, you know, women going back to work. We had Caleb on who kind of demystified the idea of coming from an internship and what that looks like turning into a career. So absolutely, it's not just about technology. I mean, obviously the tech is sometimes seen by people that are non-technical as being very hard. And by the way, it doesn't help that we keep making things into acronyms. But but that being set aside, there are lots of areas where you may think, oh yeah, everybody knows this. They probably don't. And so, you know, if it's something that, you know, you backyard parties and everybody wants to know what you do and they don't understand when you explain it, that might be something. Reach out to us because we'd love to do a podcast with you.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're shy, don't worry. You can just give us a suggestion and then we'll run off with it and claim it was our idea.
There you go.
I'm joking. But yes, please do reach out. It'd be lovely to hear from you. Yeah.
Well,
okay,
Alistair,
so that's us for... Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
No, you and I both had similar thought processes. I was going to say that's us for the day. Alistair, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always.
Same to you, Sean.
Listen out for us for the next episode.
Yep. Thanks for listening to the Technology Whisperers. We'll be back sometime very soon.